Blog Talk Radio.
Sound Health Option Show with Richard Talk To Me Guy and Sherry Edwards. Good morning, Sherry.
Good morning, Richard. Doesn't it feel like winter has finally hit?
It really does. It's actually been raining here a little bit, so yeah.
You were complaining of 37 degrees, and we have 70 here in Ohio.
I know.
What's going on here?
No climate change happening here. No, it's all normal. Wow. Sorry.
Great to hear your voice. Great to have so many good people with us. People have complained that we are too serious. We're here to help people make decisions about their health and who's telling the truth and make their life a little brighter. So we thought we would have a fun guest today. And I love the name of her book, Falling for the Stars. And she's a stunt person. I don't know if you say stunt ladies, stunt man. We'll ask her. Lisa Loving Dalton is going to be with us in just a few minutes after we do some announcements. And people have already sent in questions. I'm not sure she can answer some of them, like who's the good, bad, and ugly in Hollywood, because she has all the backdoor information. But we'll get to her in just a few minutes. We have some announcements. We are only broadcasting on Blog Talk Radio, not on WebEx as usual, but we do that on our Tuesday show where we show people's vocal print. So join us then if you want to watch the show. We don't like to watch our guests because too many people call in and say, we want to know if they're telling the truth, and we just don't want to embarrass anybody that way, but I'm still doing it behind the scenes to see what's going on because we are sponsored by the Institute of Bioacoustic Biology and Sound Health, and we are forever gathering vocal prints of people and seeing what they are. Remember that we have proven that people with similar issues have similar vocal anomalies. And from that, we have been able to tell what's going on with somebody. We just did a series of muscle injuries and trauma. And so in honor of our guest, we are going to have our sponsor today be Them Bones and Maintenance and Repair. And what we did was help a lady with a broken toe be able to use it in 8 days with no pain, totally use it, almost stand on it like a dancer would. There was no pain within a couple of hours, completely gone. Then another kid that was kicked from the side in a football game, and his knee was really damaged, and we helped him in about 20 minutes get out of pain, and that was confirmed by his chiropractor. And the third one was a lady who broke her wrist falling down steps. So that's maybe something we can ask our guest about, too. So if you're interested in being part of a drawing for those free softwares, and we'll be giving those away to whoever would like to have copies to test themselves, and it's very easy. We have a lot of demos. So if you've got a broken bone, a sprained ankle, a torn ligament, get in touch with us and see if you can be the winner of the drawing. Just write to me at Sherry, Sharry, Edwards, at gmail.com. We'll put your name in a hat for the drawing. We love giving away the softwares and helping people help themselves. I only have one announcement today, Richard, and it's about our classes that's coming up December 1st and 2nd. I believe that's not too far off, and it's going to be about weight management and metabolism. So we'll be giving away that software. The class is free. It's 2 days. It's online. Our goal is to put a bioacoustic center in every community, in every walk of life, in every place that people need support of their body, mind, and spirit. So go to our site, soundhealthoptions.com, go to classes, and it's the 2-day technician course. And we're ready to put that online now, so you can go to your computer and say, blah, 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 I just broke my arm, what do I need? And it'll tell you by way of nutrients and even by way of frequencies. I sounded very long-winded, Richard. You always have wonderful announcements about the environment.
I do have an announcement about that, but before I do that, I'll remind everybody, particularly now that we're doing the Blog Talk radio shows on Sunday, mostly audio only, that you can find the replay of this show by going to soundhealthoptions.com, click on the Blog Talk radio, the radio tab, sorry, then click on Blog Talk Radio, and then down there at the bottom will be a player that'll have the 5 most recent shows that we've done. And then if you click on the individual show that you want, it'll launch it into, it'll open another tab into Blog Talk Radio and show you all the information about the show notes, and then you can also go to Blog Talk Radio and search for Sherry Edwards, and you'll find all of the, somewhere I think we're nearing 500 shows on Blog Talk Radio, and you can also find those if you're a podcast listener or you have an app on your phone, such as if you're an iTunes or an iPhone user, you can go into iTunes and search for Sherry Edwards, and all the shows are there. My favorite app is actually Stitcher. Stitcher is going to be an app that's going to be in most dashes of new cars, so you'll be able to go to Stitcher and search for Sherry Edwards and find all the shows there as well. And this show, usually Blog Talk Radio will have the show rendered within about 15 to 20 minutes after we stop broadcasting. Now, my environmental report for today is sort of, it's a positive note, and then I have a comment that's involved about this that's really, I think, really interesting, that the Obama administration made a really wonderfully historic move today to decrease America's dependence on dirty fossil fuels, and this time they did it by protecting the Arctic Ocean from offshore drilling. So that's very cool, because the Arctic is in trouble enough from climate change, in spite of the fact that we have a bunch of people coming up that don't believe that that's happening. But the interesting thing is that the industry itself, like Shell Oil, stopped doing all drilling in the Arctic because it was just too difficult. They weren't finding enough results. They had one project where they had an offshore rig. They kept, you know, literally breaking free and, you know, like going adrift. It was just, it was an expensive, expensive process, and so they've actually begun to reduce. And another byproduct, I couldn't find that article today, this article that I'm referring to about the recent signing of this bill to protect the Arctic, that also there's an interesting trend. I know that the Trump group, President-elect Trump had said that he was going to, you know, bring back jobs, and one of the areas that he wanted to focus on was like getting coal mining going. Really, you know, like A, that's going to employ a lot of people. B, the really interesting thing about that is that that industry itself, the energy industry, has themselves, partially because the administration for the past 8 years has had to lean away from that, but also the energy-producing industry has now found that they're able to produce energy cleaner by using either, you know, solar possibilities or hydrothermal or other sources to produce energy, not only cleaner but more cost-effective. And for the industry, that's really the bottom line. So even though they want to, like, say, you know, that coal will bring back jobs to towns, the energy-producing industry isn't that interested in coal anymore because it's a big deal to mine, it's a big deal to process, and it's dirty. I don't think they care about dirty, but I think they care about the bottom line. So I think that's really cool. I'm excited about that. anything to give the environment a chance.
Affect animals. I watched a show about a lot of animals being run out of the north because of warming and problems like that.
It'll definitely, at some point, I mean, I follow a bunch of photographers on Instagram, and one of them is a National Geographic and a documentarian, and he's done a lot of photography studying areas that he's been photographing for 20 years in the Antarctic, and how he goes back and, takes photographs and sees how the glaciers have gotten broken off and how more and more, ice cap is melting. At some point, there won't be places for animals to survive because they're not ocean animals. They are land-based, even if the land is ice and glaciers. So I want to hold a more of a cold, positive spot for the Arctic, but with the amount of climate change that we have going, it's tricky. It's really tricky. Did that answer that question?
Absolutely. I know you're always concerned about Mother Earth and every place on it and all the animals there and the trees and the plant life. Somebody has to be concerned about it. I'm very concerned, too, about California and the radiation that's coming to you from Fukushima. So I'd like to remind everybody that there is a free computer program on our site under Downloads that will test you for Fukushima radiation, because I think a lot of that radiation and garbage is what's destroying the water and the air and humans. So I'm concerned about that also. I tend to write computer programs to help people see if they've been poisoned. So I'd invite all of you to go to that soundhealthoptions.com and download that free radiation exposure software.
I second that, because there really isn't much, we don't see much reports, we don't see a lot of reports of research talking about radiation until something major happens. But I mean, there's a lot of it floating around. There's a great interview. I'm actually trying to track this gentleman down who talked about, just the leaks that we have, or the potential leaks we have from our nuclear power plants, how they weren't really built to be this old, and how, there's just like issues that could be really serious, and we have leakage, and nobody really monitors that. I mean, not that they talk about it, of course. So, yeah, radiation, bad stuff, tricky, very tricky. Are we ready for me to intro our guest, an upbeat guest? I didn't mean to take us down. Man, I'm sorry. Okay, I am delighted to bring on Lisa Loving Dalton. Lisa spent years working with or stunt doubling for a galaxy of celebrity stars, including this list. Just this partial list is quite mind-blowing, actually. Madonna, Meryl Streep, Robert Redford, Katharine Hepburn, Sean Connery, Dustin Hoffman, Daryl Hannah, Michelle Pfeiffer, Robin Williams, Robert Downey Jr., Liam Neeson, Cher, and many more. Lisa reveals what it took to hang over cliffs, get hit by a moving car, drop from five stories up, dodge a bridge full of speeding cars, and to ignore the universe's more gentle prompts that it was time to quit and follow her passion into acting full-time or teaching acting. The resulting career-ending spinal injury has a story of its own, how she researched medical and alternative paths that form the heart of what she shares with the world today. She's now certified in NLP, hypnosis, and neurological repatterning, ways she learned to heal. Always seeking and finding the silver lining, she's made the most of whatever life threw at her, she says. I spill stuff, trip, and drip all of the time, so I made a career out of it. Lisa's advice, embrace what is as perfect. Lisa joined us to talk about her Amazon bestseller, Falling for the Stars, A Stunt Gal's Tattletales. Good morning, Lisa.
Good morning, Richard and Sherry. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
This is not intentionally my opening question. I have an opening question, but I have to ask right out of the gate, because I saw that name there again. How do you stunt double for Liam Neeson? How does that work?
Well, Actually, it's a little tricky in the wording. It's doubled or worked with. So.
Okay. All right.
Yes. In Liam's case, I worked with him on a film called Suspect. It was his first U.S. film, and it was with Cher, and I doubled Cher. So.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
And how did you from reading your book and reading other articles and watching some of your YouTubes, for people, I'll put these links in the show notes. Actually, in the show notes, I put the YouTube link. You have a series of live Facebook talks you did that were quite informative. You started out quite young wanting to be an actress, and you were an actress. How did you fall into being a stunt woman, being a stunt double?
Well, you know, as the bio referenced, I really am a klutz, and I was very athletic, very tomboyish, and really did want to in the long run, one could say I was angry that I was limited first to being in a female body, because I wanted to do everything the boys could do and prove it to them. And I wanted, eventually I realized I just was sort of having a hissy fit about being in any sort of body, because I wanted to defy all the laws of gravity and all the laws of this third dimension. So what I did do was I trained in gymnastics and dance to try to become less clumsy. And when I went into acting, which I started at a very early age needing to do it, but in college I hit a wall. I just wasn't a song and dance musical theater person. And so I went into the avant-garde and went into very physical theater, stage combat and clowning. And as I was pursuing my career in New York, I found I had the opportunity to work as a photo double and a stand-in on a movie. And a stand-in is a person who stands in the location where the star will be while the technicians and the cinematographers set up the lighting and the camera. And then the stand-in steps out and the star steps in and they shoot the scene. So I got invited to stand in for Tina Louise from Gilligan's Island.
Wow.
Ginger, and because I have ginger hair. And along with that, a gal named Julie Haggerty, who was, some people remember from the movie Airplane. Oh, Ted. Mm. And her character was kidnapped, so I spent a bunch of time as a photo double in the backseat of the kidnapper's car. And the kidnappers, the driver was the stunt coordinator, and the passenger was an unknown actor named Ed O'Neill, who, of course, went on to be Al Bundy and Modern Family. And I just picked the stunt coordinator's brain and did silly things during the shoot to try and impress him with my physical skills. And those silly things worked. And at the end, he hired me for a couple of stunt jobs and kind of got a launch from there.
Well, I think it's the first chapter, you talk about this. It was somewhere in the first couple of chapters, you talk about what I call this really, I mean, not only physically painful, but this amazing thing of doing a stunt with a woman wrestling in mud.
Yes.
And I mean, it just, like, you know, I've read the book, so I still feel the pain. Even when I talk about it, I wince, because the process of what you were doing, I mean, wrestling in mud, okay, that sounds fun, but I mean, really, tell the story about that, would you please? It's just really, wow.
It was really challenging. I was hired out of New York, and we were shooting up in Buffalo in November. And I was hired to mud wrestle, and I knew that part of that contract would involve having my clothes ripped off in the mud wrestling ring. So the gag, as the stunt job is called, the gag, was to be wrestling, and a drunk guy gets into the ring, decides to wrestle with us, pulls our bikinis off, and then my partner and I have to sort of haul him out of the ring, and we throw him through a window, a plate glass window out into the parking lot. And so I trained on my own time with a stunt coordinator to do the wrestling with the actress who was also wrestling with me. She wasn't a professional stunt woman, but she was reasonably athletic and she wanted to get into it. So she agreed to do this. So when we got to Buffalo, I found out that she had reneged and she had decided she was not going to mud wrestle. She was there, but she wasn't going to mud wrestle. And so the only person they could find that could do it was a lovely dance teacher in Buffalo who had very long acrylic cornered nails and who didn't know how to take a fall and who was probably 30 or 40 pounds more petite than I and 5 inches shorter than I. But because she didn't know how to take a fall, I had to take all the falls. And so that was that just sort of doubled up the challenge for me. But what really, where things really started to go awry were, first of all, I wasn't feeling very well when I went, but I didn't want to not do the job because I didn't want to disappoint everyone. And when you do that in the stunt industry, you could, you know, ruin your reputation and you could never work again. So I decided that I would, even though I felt sick, I would go ahead and go and do it and do my best. And I started having severe cramps, and so I just thought they were premenstrual, and I went on, and I got to the place where we were shooting. It was a big, vacated Western bar-type place with a mechanical bull and a huge dance floor and tables, sort of a warehouse-size place. But it was shut down, so they actually had no proper running electricity. So the film crew was bringing in all the electric, and there was no actual mud pit. So they were building a mud pit, and they were supposed to bring in bags of clean mud, Fuller's Earth, and they didn't. They brought in actual mud filled with rocks and sticks and debris, sharp debris. And they had a hose that was only connected to ice water, and it was freezing. And as we were mud wrestling, there was no way to keep us warm in between takes, and there was no way to take care of us, and they would just, like, hose us off with ice water in the mud pit. And that, over several days, made the water, the mud, thinner, which meant that every time I landed, crashed into the mud, I was now feeling the sticks, the stones, and I was getting cut and infected from the fingernails of my partner, who, you know, as lovely as she was, just, you know, there was no way this wasn't going to happen. And I became more and more ill. I was in excruciating pain. My husband was with me. He wanted me to go to the hospital, and I didn't want to, again, disappoint the production. But the stunt coordinator, I approached him after the first day and asked him to please help the conditions, and he was very, very rude to me. He was not nice. When we speak about the good, the bad, this was the bad, and basically dismissed me. But when I was at the set early that day after my discussion with him, the producer walked up to me and started asking me how things were and what he could do to help me. So I thought, oh, well, I guess the stunt coordinator did go and talk to him. And so I explained my idea of how we could ameliorate the horrible conditions here, and those ideas started to be uptaken. And But a few minutes after that, the stunt coordinator came over, screamed at me in front of everyone, and told me that I should never go by behind his back, and that if I have a problem, I'm supposed to come to him, and basically didn't speak to me for the next 3 days. And at one point that night, they brought me to a shower that was in the empty kitchen. It happened to be right next to the door to the parking lot where all the campers were. And they brought me there and they said, here, you can clean off here. They brought me in a towel. And then the production assistant took the towel and went to get me clean towels. And the shower had a flimsy curtain. And I turned on the water and it was ice cold. And I saw there was a hot water. I turned the hot water. It was a separate spigot, and it scalded me. And so I was so tremoring, shaken, and in pain and freezing. And the production assistant never came back. And the door to the outside was open and blowing chilled, icy air. And finally, after about 10 minutes, I was trying to call to people. No one was around. I finally ran frozen, scalded, mud-covered, naked across the gravel parking lot into the camper of the customer who immediately got me into the shower there and got me some clothes and got me warm and eventually got me back to the hotel. In the final upshot, a stunt person gets what they call an adjustment, depending on the degree of difficulty and the number of takes that it would take. And the stunt coordinator has a budget that they have to parcel out by their own choice. And this whole time, I just was sort of hoping that somehow I would at least be rewarded financially for this, as the person, aside from the guy who went through the plate glass window, who was repeatedly exposed to the greatest amount of danger. I found out that the girl who reneged, who one night I saw wandering off with one of the friends of the stunt coordinator, all she did was hit somebody over the head with a bottle, a fake glass bottle. And I found out that she had a $250 stunt adjustment, while the guy who went through the window had a $300 adjustment and everyone else had a $150 adjustment. So I hadn't heard what my adjustment was. I called the stunt coordinator and he told me, you're an actress. You were never working for me. You don't get a stunt adjustment. Mm. And I had a contract that said, yes, I was an actress, but it specifically said that I got a stunt adjustment. And my husband and I had actually ridden our motorcycles up there because we were going to go on a motorcycle trip when this happened. So we rode there, and we decided that I was so sick by that time that we really should just ride home. But we got about 2 hours south of Buffalo, checked into a motel. He called an ambulance. I wound up in the hospital for a week. I had a miscarriage. And that was what was going on. And the best the hospital could figure was it had happened sometime a day or two before, because all my tests were showing I was still pregnant. But they couldn't find the fetus anywhere, that they wouldn't let me go anywhere. They wouldn't give me any medications I had severe hemorrhaging and stuff. They wouldn't give me any medications that might damage the fetus, despite that they couldn't find it. It was horrible. I will say it was horrible. I did turn to my union, who helped. Eventually, it took me about 6 months to finally get a stunt adjustment. They first offered me $150. I refused. I finally got a $250 adjustment. I was blackballed by that producer and that stunt coordinator for the next 6 years. They refused to hire me. However, I did, after 6 years, there was a job. I think it just went long enough that maybe the producer forgot about it, or they just needed so many stunt people at once that they didn't pay attention. And I got hired on a film, and I saw the producer standing alone with no urgent things to deal with. And so I walked up to him and reintroduced myself and reminded him that he had failed to hire me on several projects, and informed him of what I had, in fact, sacrificed for him, and that I appreciated him hiring me back after all these years. But I was proud of myself for telling him exactly what I felt he needed to know and what I needed to have said to make my point clear. So I know this is a long story, but...
Well, I think that the amazing part to me is that in spite of that experience, you still stuck with it. What was it about stunting? Were you acting in between doing stunts, or did you move into being more of a stunt person because you proved your, I don't know what that salt, I'm not sure what the correct on-air word is, your bravery, your willingness to, like, you know, stick it out and, you know, that kind of, I mean, this is... I suspect long enough ago, even though it wasn't that long ago in the, you know, light and everything, that today there would, the standard and practices, I don't know if that's a phrase even used in the industry, but I mean, I suspect today the amount of safety and everything involved, that kind of thing would not be allowed to occur today. And yet you did it, you survived it, and you continued to want to do it again. What was it about stunting and being in the industry that really held you?
Yeah. Well, I was simultaneously having an acting career. And in fact, a month after I did my very first stunt, I discovered an approach to acting that transformed my own work as an actor. And it actually transformed me spiritually. I had really been going through a sort of a reaction against religion from a very religious upbringing, and had sort of moved into my atheistic phase, then moved into more holistic phases. But this acting technique really opened up a whole creative spiritual world for me. And I, along with learning that, I invested a great deal of what I earned through stunts in mastering this particular acting technique. I was also a professional clown comedian at the same time, entertaining at gala affairs, and that was extraordinarily lucrative. I was making more on a weekend doing clown work than I would have been on Broadway. And so I teamed up with a group of also entertainers like that, and we would produce plays Monday through Thursday. And so I was always working these sort of two economic factors, the stunt world and the comedy world, to move my acting forward. And so there were two things about why I stuck with the stunts. One was I really do love the sort of scientific athletic accomplishment that's in it, having, you know, being a klutz. If I can do something really well, skillfully and gracefully, it's a really great overcoming. And and I look at it scientifically. What is the trajectory? What are the angles? What is the speed? What is the dynamic of the spin and the launch and these kinds of things? So more so than Daredevil, I really think of it as a scientific athletic accomplishment. I did love meeting all those amazing people, and the good and the bad. It was such an enlightening world for me. And I was also a teacher. I was working with outreach programs and hospital audiences and all sorts of things like that. So I started doing special workshops on how to overcome fear, working with inner city children about their fears from a stunt gal's perspective. And so I was gaining a bit of cachet in that respect, to be able to share uplifting and healing things with people. So that was very attractive. And honestly, my ego was terribly caught up in, you know, being one of a handful of women who was doing these amazing feats.
Yeah.
So,
I have a question from the audience that has an urgent edge to it. Why did Cher need a stunt double? I don't think of Cher in an action movie per se. What did you do with Cher?
It's a good question. It was, you know, every time you do a stunt, you're hired because there's a danger to someone, whether it's a doubling situation like it was with Cher, or whether you're the nondescript person who's like diving out of the way of the vehicle or accidentally, you know, punched in the bar. In Suspect, Cher is a lawyer, and in her, she's sitting in jammed up traffic in Washington, D.C., and kids come and shatter her car window and steal her bag and briefs. And so I am doubling Cher when those kids shatter the window. That way, if the glass cuts, I'm the one that's getting cut rather than Cher.
And when you're working with an actress, I don't know, I'll use Madonna's name because I have it. I'm not sure what the movie was, but my question is, do you, as the stunt double, kind of study how that person moves? So as you go into whatever action you're going to do, that you can try and physically at least mimic them to a certain extent? Does that make sense?
Yes, that is exactly what I do, and it's one of the reasons why I became so solidly anchored in the stunt field, was because my acting technique teaches you how to do that with the character you want to become, how to look at the tempo, the rhythm, the location of the energy, the flow and dynamic of it, the degree of resistance that they move with. Like some people move more like earth or water or air or fire. And so I can look at Madonna and say, wow, she has strong energy in her navel when she's performing in her videos, and she has a strong energy in her eyes. So I can put my energy in my eyes like that, my energy in my navel like that, and I can already start to sense how she's going to move. But an interesting thing happened with her, because I was doubling her on Saturday Night Live. She was the season opener host, 1985, right after she married Sean Penn. And the only TV appearance, I believe, to date that she had made at that time was, in fact, on Johnny Carson's Tonight Show. And she was very demure, and it surprised everybody. And it made the Saturday Night Live producers nervous, because, of course, the host has their whole opening monologue and they have the various sketches that they do. So the producers decided to create two videos and shoot them the week before. And this did two things for them. It gave them an opportunity to work with Madonna in advance of finalizing the sketches, so they could customize them to who she was. And it also gave them the opportunity to control the monologue. So they made a video for the monologue of Madonna's wedding. And if people remember, Madonna and Sean got married out in Malibu, and it was a big secret. But the press found out about it, and these helicopters came over, and supposedly Sean Penn took pot shots with his gun at the helicopters. So in this video, well, for the opening monologue, Madonna walked out with a huge newspaper front page of the New York Times and spun it around, and on the back was a full-page invitation from Sean and Madonna for everyone to attend their wedding. So she came out and she said, "We invited you all and you didn't show up at our wedding, so I'm going to make you watch my home video." And in the home video, it was very funny because all of Madonna's family, grandfather and the nieces and nephews, whatever, were all, whatever they were wearing, on top of it, they had a black bra, big red lips, a mole, and a big bow in their hair. And all of Sean's family were in baby blue chiffon, and they would hit the camera every time it came near. And for the wedding, Father Guido Sarducci was the priest, and Robert Downey Jr. played Sean Penn. And I and Madonna in her bridal vest, veil, and gown, which had a very long, full veil. And it was right after Michael Jackson had caught on fire in a Pepsi commercial. What they did in the sketch was they intercut the helicopters from Apocalypse Now with the wedding ceremony. So you had to greet Father Guido Sarducci saying, "Do you a Madonna? Take a you a Sean? Do a," and intercut the helicopters, whoop, 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 and then Madonna going, "What? What?" And finally, Madonna gets mad. She throws a bouquet down. She picks up a big Laws rocket bazooka and blows the helicopters out of the sky. So in my book, you see the picture of the big backflash on my back, the fire flame on my back, which, you know, ostensibly could have set the whole dress and veil on fire. Mm-hmm. So that's what I did. But what was interesting is earlier I had shot a scene where, for a later thing, where she gets attacked, and I had to get attacked for her. And I had to shoot my part before all of this, and before I got to see her at all or meet her. And I had to fight. And I was modeling her because I also impersonated her at these bar mitzvahs and dances and things. I was impersonating her strength. So I sort of fought rather fiercely. And then she came on and she had to do the close-up part of that. And it was more like the Johnny Carson version of, you know, this very demure. And so then when I went to finish it, then I was having been able to see how she was actually moving much more demurely than I thought, that I realized, you know, she really creates a character for her videos and things like that, and that she hadn't really built her strength outside of that yet. But can I tell you something, Richard and Sherry? I would like to work with Madonna, I believe, as an acting coach, that if Madonna worked with me within 2 years, she would have an Oscar. Huh. I believe that.
Huh. So, well, she's an amazing, you know, she's an amazing, based on what you're saying, and from just having watched her down through the years, she has evolved into an amazing performer, and I remember that Carson interview. I'm old enough that I remember all that. And I remember that Carson interview when she did come out, and she was, as you said, very demure, very, like, people were surprised that she was so, I can't say shy, but she was so not the person when people think of Madonna today, they think of her more as a warrior. And back then, she was still, I'd almost say, kind of mousy in a certain way. So I think it would be interesting to see her evolve into being an actress, because she has great potential, because she now has an amazing presence. Love or hate her, she has an amazing presence.
Yes, yes, exactly.
She feels like a Meryl Streep presence.
I think with the right technique, and the interesting thing is Meryl, and, you know, it was such an honor to work with Meryl. She was amazing. That Meryl's approach to acting is very much like the work that I teach, and I do think that you know, if Madonna learned those same tools that Meryl uses, that she could be quite a contender as an actress.
We have another question here from the audience. Does being a stunt double ruin the movie for you because you are so familiar with what is fake? And then I want to ask, what's the biggest fooler do you think the audience has been taken in about that you see? And you can cut it down into this step and do that and do that. But we're out here believing it all. So what should we look for, and what was your experience?
I've had so many areas I've been in. I was also a magician's assistant. And when I first learned magic, the magic went away. So that's the same metaphor here, that when you first learn how it goes behind the scenes, you see, wow, this is a lot of hurry up and wait. There's just all these other things that happen. But after a while, you start to look at the magic of movie making, in a whole new way, where you can really appreciate, because you're looking to see the cheat, you're looking to see where the cut happened, where did they switch from the double to, you know, from the actor to the double, for example. How did they capture this moment? Where did they place the camera angle to make that punch look like it really landed? So the biggest trick is camera angle, I would say. I'll give you an example on that. I was working on a film doubling Kelly McGillis called House on Carroll Street, and I had to dodge a train. And Kelly dodged the train. She ran across the tracks, and the train was, 500 yards away, moving very, very slowly. And then I stepped in, they changed the camera angle, and they sped up the train, and I just barely missed the train. And so the effect of that was like one process. Now, in that case, Peter Yates, the director who is famous for Bullet, came up to me after I dodged that train, and he grabbed me and said, "Don't ever do that to me again, because that was way too close. Let me show you the camera again so you can see. You can do it much sooner because we won't be able to tell the difference." And so it's important for the stunt person to know where is the lens, what is this lens seeing, and what is the depth of field of the lens. Because I could punch you, and I could be a foot away from you. If the camera's in the right place, then it'll look like I hit you. If the camera's in the wrong place, you'll see that I was a foot away from you. So,
How does that get set up? I didn't mean to go into this, but it just comes to mind. Who coordinates between the DP, the director of photography, and the director, and the stunt coordinator? Where's that interface come that the director of photography can say that to the stunt coordinator, or is now the industry so educated everybody kind of knows can do that? I mean, how does that, besides the director coming to you and telling you that, how does that happen?
It starts with the stunt coordinator, and today the stunt coordinators and the cinematographers and the directors are doing a thing that they call pre-vis, V-I-S, which means pre-visualization. So the stunt coordinator has a tablet, like iPad or whatever, tablet, and they rehearse and prepare, and they actually shoot. They make a little video on their tablet of what they think the scene will look like. And then they bring it to the cinematographer and the director, and they show them what it's looking like. And if the director and cinematographer like it, then they recreate that. So it's empowered the stunt coordinator even more today with this pre-vis opportunity. In the past, the assistant director brings those people together, the coordinator, the cinematographer, and the director. And they've had a meeting where they've designed based on the locations that they have or the set that they have, what exactly they think will happen. Then they get to the set and they try to put all the pieces into place according to what they've planned, and they shift and adjust based on the conditions that they discover right there. So everybody then gets a better understanding. The stunt coordinator disseminates that information to the stunt players, and the assistant director gives the information to the actors themselves, and the cinematographer gives the information to the technicians, the camera operators, the grips, and the electricians to rig the lighting, and the director then rehearses the actors, the coordinator rehearses the stunt players, and then they put it all together.
It's an amazing dance. I was a chef in a restaurant that did a lot of catering, and a number of times we would cater, because we had a catering division, we would cater movies that were shot on the Monterey Peninsula. And so we'd be with a movie for the, 4 to 6 weeks they were on, serving them three meals a day. And the part that I don't think people know about is, to me, it was just stunning how much time there is standing around and just waiting. I mean, just waiting, just like waiting and waiting and waiting and waiting. It's like a meditation, or you go nuts.
It is.
It's amazing how much time. I mean, some of the complex things that I think, the stuff that I was, because I was actually in the field doing, feeding the people, I'd get to talk to them and see, and, you'd stand around for hours, and then a shot would be like 30 seconds, and then you'd stand around for hours resetting the shot and the angles and the things. I mean, it seems almost tedious in that sense. But I did see that it was a very tight-knit community. Well, unless somebody disliked somebody else, and then it was really bad. But, is it a tight community? I mean, are you kind of a family of sorts?
Absolutely, especially when you work on a series or a big film for a longer time, you really do become a very tight community. And it does require a lot of focus and attention to be aware of what each part of the larger organism is doing. I mean, you know that if you get a paper cut, it affects your whole body. You feel that little paper cut on your little finger, and it's throbbing. It's just this little teeny slice in your skin, but you have your whole organism is aware of it. So when there's a vulnerability in the organism of a film set, it is felt, and it's felt because someone is late, or because a piece of equipment fails. Any number of things can happen, and the process, as you said, is so tedious, and most of the time you're doing 12 to 14 hour days. So the challenge for stunt people is to stay warmed up and ready. The challenge for actors is to stay focused and be ready. The challenge for everybody is to be able to engage themselves in some level of amusing themselves in the terribly boring times, but staying on high alert so that if they are the ones who are up next to do their task, that they're absolutely right there on the ready.
Mm-hmm. Amazing. I have a redirect of sorts. I want to talk about I'd like you to talk to us about this amazing injury that you had. You talk about it in your book, and you talk about how you really look at it now as a gift. How was that, and how did it change your life?
After a certain length of time in the industry, as I kept growing with the acting world that I was in, I realized more and more that I wasn't supposed to be staying in the stunt field longer. I had gotten pigeonholed. My acting opportunities weren't growing from the theater productions that I was doing. I was being highly regarded by the casting people, but they weren't auditioning me for Broadway and for major film roles and things like that. So it wasn't progressing because they had typecast me as a stunt woman. And I'd been warned about this, that if I stayed in it longer than 5 years, that would happen. The thing was that it had taken me 5 years to get my reputation established and everything else. So, and I loved it. And so I decided that I needed to stop, I needed to leave, and I had been living in New York, so my husband and I moved to California, and I was bi-coastal I flew back to California 37 times, I mean to New York 37 times in 18 months to do jobs and to do the entertainment because I couldn't let go of the income. And, you know, it's just, I had sort of become a bit hedonistic. I mean, I had a wall 15 feet long with five shelves on it full of high-end cowboy boots because I rode my motorcycle most of the time. It was, you know, that was indulgent. And I needed to walk away and just start from scratch and focus on the acting and teaching. And so I decided after I took a six-month break from going back and I decided to hire movers. And the night before I left, they called me up and said, Lisa, you're coming to New York. We need you. We have this rappelling off a cliff job. You're the only one qualified because the girl who was going to do it is coming to Los Angeles. And you're coming here. How convenient. It must be perfect. And you're actually a better double for her. You're more like her height and her body. And so this will be great. And we really need you. And we love you, blah, blah, blah. So I said, okay. And it was December. It was freezing. And I again, sort of did over due diligence because I volunteered to fix a production flaw. No one had told them that I was going to be there, and the stunt double they thought was coming was much more petite than I, and they didn't have any police pants that fit me, and I was doing this all on second unit, which means the regular director and everybody were going to be doing shooting in another area, and this they were sending me because they knew me and trusted me and that I could put on the wig and the costume and everything and look great. So they had no police pants for me, New York police pants, and I said, no problem, I've got my own. I had my own New York and New Jersey police pants, and I went back to my apartment, which was already in boxes, and I couldn't find the New York pants. I found New Jersey pants with a baby blue stripe. I spent 2 hours making that baby blue stripe black with a fine point Sharpie. I got an hour and a half sleep. Wow. I went to the set, was 15 minutes early. It was 7 a.m. in the morning. It was 30 degrees. We were on the cliffs overlooking the Hudson River, Palisade Cliffs, and we started to go. We were just a partner and I dropping down about 25 feet off this 400-foot cliff, but just to a ledge to rescue a fallen hiker. And they had four cameras set up, and one of the cameras seemed to be frozen, so they thought they'd wait. They came and said, all right, we're going to do this in the afternoon when it's a little warmer. And so I went to my camper and I went to sleep. 20 minutes later, they grabbed me, and they said, we're going now. And I was in a fog. I was unprepared. I forgot to put one of the pads that I used to protect myself on my spine. When I went down the cliff, I pushed off and the rope slipped off the edge. It was like I was on a peninsula, the end of a peninsula, and it slipped off the edge. And while I didn't move on the rope gained about 25 feet, ricocheted back and forth between two walls of the cliff and crashing into my spine, my head, et cetera. Ultimately, over the next 4 years, it took a year to get a proper diagnosis. Everyone told me there was nothing wrong with me, but I was an invalid. I was in chronic pain. I couldn't walk. And finally, they figured out that my spine had destabilized, so the vertebrae just were moving out of position, three vertebrae just moving around, crushing the discs and the nerves. So I would be walking along and suddenly fall down for no apparent reason and things like that. So they said, three different surgeons said, delay surgery as long as possible. It's too dangerous. It won't guarantee it'll fix the problem, and nor will it guarantee it will alter your chronic pain. And that's when I really set out to find out how to work with this excruciating pain and began my research into energy management and in a variety of areas, the hypnosis. Of course, I did meditation and yoga and various practices to take myself through what I needed to do to tolerate chronic pain, to be able to walk at all, walk, sit, stand. They considered me to have a 46% permanent loss of use of my back and virtually unemployable. But I managed to make a full career on camera as an actress. And also, I ran a studio in Los Angeles, the Michael Chekhov Acting Studio in Los Angeles for 18 years. And what I learned from the alternative health and quantum and metaphysics and things like that actually explained why I loved the acting technique so much. And I began to be able to teach it in a whole new way. And I taught it all over, in Russia, Moscow, Petersburg, Berlin, Paris, London, all over this country. And it became a miraculous gift to me that I had this injury, because I had to learn how to deal with extreme high levels of stress and on a chronic level, and be able to cope and find a tremendous amount of forgiveness and experiment with all sorts of wonderful things.
What a wonderful story. We have a quick question from our audience, and then I can't believe it, but we have to close. What is the best and worst people that you had to work with?
I'm going to start with the worst, and I think the worst was that stunt coordinator that I talked about. I did have one other who was forced to hire three women for every, out of every 10 people he hired, three of them had to be women. And he, in setting up the stunt, was a film with Sean Connery called Wrong is Right. He refused to give me any job to do. He refused to, he created the fight sequences with all the men, and he just ignored me and never looked at me. So I just went and created my own scenario. I decided I was going to protect Sean Connery from getting attacked, and that's what I did. I went about my business, but I could have spent the whole time at the craft table munching food and walked away. So, you know, when you encounter people who are not pleasant, I feel that you need to look at the higher goal of the project. I did have a guy who abused me terribly and fired me on a set. And within 15 minutes, the producer came to me and hired me back directly. And I know that guy was on, I'm pretty positive that guy was on cocaine. So one needs to really be aware of that. Now, on the flip side, both Madonna and Cher, they're my tie for the best. They both went out of their way to step up for unprofessional situations that I was being confronted with. And Cher also sent me an autographed picture of us together, which was great. And Meryl made sure that I got a contract when someone was trying to convince me, while we were sitting next to each other in makeup, and which was very embarrassing for me, tried to convince me to do a stunt without actually having a stunt contract. So Meryl Streep and Cher are just a number one.
How cool. And how do people, because we are, I'm surprised we got here so fast, do you work with people one-on-one today, or do you teach classes? And if you do you do stuff online, or is it all in person? How do people work with you? Where do they find you? Where would you like people to get your book? All that kind of information.
LisaDalton.com is the key to it all. And the answer, Richard, to everything you just said is yes, I work online. I have clients in New Zealand and Italy and various places. I have workshops. I've got an upcoming workshop at the University of Florida, December 27th to January 2nd. That's a full intensive program in this fun and freeing approach to acting, Michael Chekhov's technique. And that, and I have on my website at lisadalton.com, I have free chapters of the book, and there are some bonus. There's an MP3 that you can hear me talking about how the acting exercises are used, how I use those also to help heal me, and how you can use that. So part of my work is speaking and teaching groups and individuals how to use a body, mind, spirit approach to healing themselves and to increasing their performance, whether it's the performance of life, my company Peak Performance Living, to live your life in the peak performance, or whether it's for public speaking or for teaching or for acting, directing, writing, etc. So yes to all of those.
Yes to everything. Of course, yes. You'd have a presence online. I've seen some of your work, the live shoots you did on Facebook Live, which I think is an admirable tool. I mean, and obviously, you're an actress. You have an on-camera presence. So, you know, it's almost a silly question. So I think that's really great.
Lisa,
you know, go ahead.
No, I was going to say there. I do have Lisa Dalton's YouTube channel, so that has a whole variety of videos, including the ones you were referencing, if someone would like to see those.
Right, and I put all of that information in the show notes at Blog Talk Radio. So again, for people who want to look at those show notes and look at, you know, find all of Lisa's links, that's available, I believe, also at soundhealthoptions.com. Again, radio tab and then Blog Talk Radio, the links are there. And or you can go to the link to Blog Talk Radio, and you can find a brief bio on Lisa, and also all of her links are there as well. Because I'm laughing again. You're an actress. You have, you have a presence online. Of course you have a presence online. What would we be thinking, for God's sakes? It's the 20th century, 21st century. Of course you have a presence. That was quite an adventure. And you're still riding a motorcycle today. I see that you've been a motorcycle junkie since you were young, and you still have that as a passion. Yeah,
I do. My little Shih Tzu rides on my lap.
The perfect motorcycle riding dog. That's great. That was quite an adventure. Thank you so much, Lisa. That was great.
Thank you. Thank you both.
Everybody have a great rest of the week, and we'll see you on Tuesday. I'm not sure what we're talking about, but I know what you're going to be talking. See you on Tuesday. Everybody have a great rest of the weekend. Bye-bye.
You're a brave lady. Thank you for being on.
Oh, thank you, Sherry, so much. I really, really enjoyed it, and love to come back again sometime.
Thank you again.
Thank you.